Good morning. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On the show today, I'm talking with Rebecca Hanrahan, professor of philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and we're discussing Richard Russo's Empire Falls. Rebecca, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Could you begin by giving the listener a brief summary of the main themes, the central themes in Empire Falls?
This is a story about a man, Miles Roby, who has lived most of his life in a dying mill town named Empire Falls. As a boy, he, his mother, Grace Roby, and other members of the town saw Miles as having a potential to live a life richer than any kind of life that one could have in Empire Falls. Specifically, they saw him as having the potential of becoming a great scholar. Unfortunately, Miles never got to live up to this potential. He never got to become or embody his true nature, and that's largely because he felt he had certain duties he had to fulfill towards others. This book concerns the middle years of Miles' life, and it mostly deals with his reconciling himself to the fact that he's never going to become the man he wants to become. Of course, intertwined throughout Miles' story is the story of other members of Miles' community.
Could you mention a couple of those, especially those that might be relevant to the rest of the discussion?
Well, one of the stories that's quite prominent is the story of his mother, Grace Roby. Grace Roby married young and married unhappily. In her middle years, she met a man that she fell in love with, and she subsequently had an affair with him. Now, Grace Roby was also a Catholic, so her having this affair, again, conflicted with her true nature, and it was also in her mind a sin. As the book sort of proceeds, she at one point confesses this sin to the woman whose husband she cheated with, Mrs. Whiting. Mrs. Whiting then spends the rest of her life pretty much taking out her anger on Grace. And what she does is pretty much ruin Grace's life and, in some ways, Miles's as well.
Now, a couple times you use the language of people having a nature. In fact, you talked about this conflict between Miles not being able to pursue his nature. Is this a pretty important theme in the book, the idea that people have a nature?
Oh, yes. I think it's central to the book.
What exactly does someone mean when they say that people have a nature, and how does it play out in this book?
Well, as I read the book, and I think there are multiple ways of reading this book, I think Russo is making a very strong claim that each of us has a true nature. There's some way that each of us can't help but be. And in fact, if we do anything to deny this nature in any way, we're going to bring a certain amount of misery into our lives. Now, the best way we can sort of see this is by considering those characters in the book that, in fact, obey their true nature. These characters are by far the happiest people in Empire Falls. One wonderful example of this is Miles's father, Max. Now, Max is, in many ways, reprehensible. He's slovenly, he's selfish, he's devious. He has pretty much every bad character trait you can list. He recognizes that of himself. He doesn't have any problem with this fact about himself, and he does nothing to change it. And one of the reasons he does nothing to change it is because he sort of thinks it's impossible. And not only does he think it's impossible for him to change his sort of true nature, everybody else in the book does as well. And they repeatedly make the claim that Max is just Max. Now, if you compare Max then to some of the other characters, some of the more unhappy characters, you'll see that they're the characters that are always trying to change their true nature or in some ways deny it. I've already sort of spoken about Miles. Miles is doesn't try to change his true nature as much as he isn't able ever to embody that true nature. Things in his life conspired, so he never became that scholar he wanted to become. Now, another way of sort of messing with your true nature that brings about misery is when you do try to change it. The sort of primary example of that is Janine. Janine is Miles' soon-to-be ex-wife, and she, more than anything, doesn't want to be Miles's wife anymore. She wants to create for herself a new life, a new way to be. Now, she takes most of her energy for this change into losing weight. She really tries to lose weight. She spends a tremendous amount of time exercising and fighting her desires to eat. But in the end, all this fighting is futile, and she gains back all the weight she loses. And it's as if Rousseau is saying, you know, don't try to change. You're supposed to be fat, Janine. End of story. Right. So it's a very strong notion that we have a nature that we can't do anything to change and would be better off if we just stuck with that nature.
Okay. What do you think about that view?
Well, first of all, I think it's horribly pessimistic, and I'm pretty sure it will put a lot of people out of work. I think in general, people have abilities, propensities. I'm better at doing certain things than others, but I don't think this in any way constitutes a true nature. Moreover, I think whether or not you sort of act on those abilities or do the things that you're most able or best able to do largely depends upon the situation you've been put in your life. So there's no true nature there. There are circumstances that propel you in one way or another, and maybe in time, certain things will be easier for you than others, but this in no way constitutes a nature that's unchangeable in any way. Okay. Change my situation, change my nature.
Actually, I'm not sure if this example will suit what you just said, but as soon as you said it, I thought of it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of the people whose parents pushed them into being, for example, a tennis star from the time they're very young.
Mm-hmm.
And they succeed. They end up being great tennis players. Now, was it their nature that made them a great tennis player, or was it the fact that they were put in this environment in which, from the time they were very young, they were put in a tennis court, given a tennis racket, and told to play tennis? I take it you want to say it's the latter.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, that's not to say that if my parents had forced me to be a tennis player, I would be as good as Venus Williams right now. No, probably not, but I'd be a much better tennis player than I am right now. I think people do have certain abilities that other people don't have, but they're not all that specific, and they can be shaped in various ways. And whether they come to the fore will really depend upon how that child or that adult is treated.
Okay, so most people would have a wide variety of abilities, any of which they might be able to embody if given the opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And it just depends in part upon what the opportunities may be made available to the person.
Yeah. That's what I think.
Well, now, I mean, those are all examples, though, of I mean, we're talking about being a good tennis player, for example, but the point is perhaps more important when we talk about what might be considered moral traits. You mentioned Max earlier, that mm-hmm. he was slovenly, dishonest. Sometimes people use that language, too, to defend themselves. Yeah, I know I'm deceitful, and there just isn't anything I can do about it.
Right.
I mean, what would you, as a teacher and a philosopher, say to them if they said, well, I can't do anything about it. I'm just mean. I'm nasty. I'm inconsiderate. I'm selfish.
Well, mostly I'd say that I think that they were fooling themselves, right? That for most of these traits, there's a choice that you have to make, right? I mean, I am not the neatest person in the world, but I make certain choices in my life. And I say, well, okay, I have an urge to throw, you know, to not pick up after myself. But I say, well, let's fight that urge, right, and pick up. And sometimes it'll be, depending upon the day or the time of the week it is or the kind of person I am, it'll be hard or easy to fight that urge, but there's still a choice there. And the question you have to ask when you have such traits are, how hard are you going to fight that urge?
And if you fight it long enough, maybe you no longer have the urge?
Right.
Okay. Now, there's a second thing I'd like to pick up on that you mentioned in your first answer. You said that Miles stayed around Empire Falls because of circumstances, and one of the circumstances certainly had to do with his mother, that he felt the need to care for his mother, and also that his mother had sort of thrust upon him an expectation that he would befriend Cindy Whiting, who was mm-hmm. the daughter of Miss Whiting. Cindy, at a very early age, had been hit by a car, presumably by a stranger, and crippled, and that he was supposed to care for her, to take this on as some kind of duty or responsibility. This theme that people have certain duties or responsibilities that they need to take on is also a theme that runs through this book. Could you give some other examples of where this notion of duty plays a role in the book and exactly what Rousseau's views on duties are and the way that our failures to fulfill our duties may harm other people?
Yeah, what I think is interesting here about what Rousseau is doing, is that he's kind of turning over our notion of duty. I mean, there's a way in which when we think about somebody fulfilling their duties, we can't help but sort of think, well, then they're doing a good thing, then they're doing the right thing, they're doing the helpful thing, right? Fulfilling your duties is good, we usually assume. But Rousseau is, in some ways, playing with that notion here. I think for Rousseau, one of the primary ways we harm other people is by fulfilling our duties, but in the barest minimal way, right? So a really nice example is Mrs. Whiting in The Grill. Mrs. Whiting says to Miles, "Miles, if you come and manage the grill for me, I will will you that grill when I die." Mrs. Whiting does nothing to break that promise. She shows Miles her will. It says it in the will. Yes, Miles will get that grill. She doesn't break that promise, but she does everything she can to make sure that this grill is not profitable. She does everything she can to make sure the property the grill is in is worthless, that the machines at the grill are worthless. So while she's sort of living up to the letter of her agreement, she will give Miles the grill. She's certainly not living up to the promise, the spirit of that agreement. And that fact makes her promise virtually empty and harms Miles in all sorts of ways. Miles thinks he's about to get this grill that is valuable and that once having it, he'll have a certain amount of freedom in his life. But if the grill is worthless, there'll be no freedom there for him.
Okay. Are there any other good examples?
Oh, I think the other good examples are when we talk about Miles's relationship with Cindy. Again, that's Mrs. Whiting's daughter who's been crippled. Miles is asked to befriend Cindy, and Miles always acts as if he's Cindy's friend. He helps her in various ways, but again, he always does just the minimum. But the minimum is enough for Cindy to fall in love with Miles. And this love isn't returned by Miles, and that causes Cindy great pain to the point that she tries to kill herself multiple times. The same story is almost played out again with Tick, that's Miles's daughter, and a boy, John Voss. Tick is asked to befriend John Voss. Again, Tick acts as if John is her friend, but isn't really his friend. And this causes John, in some ways, to go off the deep end. And again, tragedy ensues. So here, over and over throughout the book, we have people undertaking certain duties, making certain promises, and doing the minimum to fulfill those promises, those duties. And it's the minimum, they're only doing the minimum, that subsequently causes harm to others.
Okay. I mean, I wonder about all those cases. Part of me would want to say, yeah, excuse me, they are doing the minimum. Part of me wants to say they're doing enough so that no one can complain a whole lot about them not even doing the minimum.
Yeah.
That we're not real sure just how badly they're failing to live up to their responsibilities.
But don't you think that's part of the problem, right?
Okay.
Because they're just doing the minimum, we can't call them on it, right? We can't say, Mrs. Whiting, you're doing me wrong, right, by not sort of living up to the spirit of this agreement. Because Mrs. Whiting can always say back, what have I done? I haven't done anything. I'm going to give you the grill. I haven't lied to you. So we can't sort of confront her and make her change her behavior because she's close to right. But merely being close isn't good enough sometimes.
Do you think Rousseau sees this as a flaw on Miss Whiting's part, Miles' part, and Tick's part? Is it a flaw that they aren't living up to their responsibilities?
That's a hard question to answer. I think it really will depend upon the character. Mrs. Whiting seems to be much more malicious in what she's doing. She seems to be much more calculating. She seems to be knowing that she's only giving the bare minimum, and she's giving the bare minimum because she knows the bare minimum will cause more harm than good. Now, Tick and Miles, on the other hand, I think if it's a flaw, it's a kind of tragic flaw. It's something that they can't help. They're doing the best they can when they befriend these people. So it's not the same kind of flaw that maybe Mrs. Whiting has.
So in the case of Miss Whiting, she's actually using her responsibility and knowingly not living up to it. Mm-hmm. And again, in some way, using it to try to manipulate mm-hmm. and control Miles. Whereas Miles and Tick simply don't have the commitment or the affection toward Cindy or John that they might need mm-hmm. in order to act decently toward them.
Yeah.
In the second half of the show, I want to pick up on that theme and some of the other themes in this book. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Rebecca Hanrahan, professor of philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and we're discussing Richard Russo's Empire Falls. I know you teach, among other courses, you teach issues in ethics and values.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say about this idea that many times harms to others befall them because people simply minimally meet their responsibilities? Is that a fair assessment of the way in which people are often harmed?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a way people often can sleep at night, right? So people have duties in this world, things that they have to do, that they have a moral responsibility to do. Doing them is often onerous and tiresome and takes a lot out of a person. There's such that we don't want to fulfill those duties, so we do the bare minimum so that we don't feel bad about ourselves and can sleep at night, but yet also so that that duty doesn't sort of impinge too much on our lives. I mean, I think it's our way of cheating morality, right, and letting ourselves off the hook in a bunch of ways. You get this most when you talk about poverty, right? Over and over again, we have all sorts of arguments presented to us, and arguments that most of us accept, be they religious or ethical in nature, that tell us that we need to be giving more to help the poor. And a lot of people will give $2 or $3 a week, and that'll be the bare minimum. But most everybody agrees that they're supposed to be doing more. But the bare minimum lets us sleep at night.
In some sense, almost intentionally evading
our
full responsibilities.
Yeah.
What do we do about that? How do we deal with that, confront that proclivity on our part?
Well, I think one of the things we do is we try to connect up these duties more to the sense we have in ourselves, So my students here at ETSU are religious. Lots of them are Christians, and they take their Christianity very important. And I try to take what they value in themselves about themselves and about their lives and connect it up with these duties, right? So that they see that, well, if they really want to be this Christian or this kind of person, well, then you've got to look more at these duties that you're just barely fulfilling, right? Try to make the duties reflect more or make them connected more to the lives they want to live or the kind of person they want to be.
I mean, in general, would that be a way of trying to get people to think about their obligations is to not to see them as simply something external imposed upon them, but something internal that somehow becomes part of who they are?
Yes, and it's also something they've chosen for themselves. I mean, my students here, it's very important that they've chosen to be Christians. Well, okay, making that choice means you've also bought certain duties that you have to sort of fulfill.
All right, I want to move on and talk about a third theme in the book that I suppose any novel today, any novel is going to focus to some degree upon romantic relationships. Certainly there are any number of relationships, romantic relationships, long-term relationships that are discussed in the book. But in my reading, most of them fail. They either completely fail so that the people break up, or they fail in the sense that the people stay together, but they're miserable. I may be wrong about this, but from my recollection, there's really only one relationship, and it's more alluded to than focused on, which might be thought to be a happy, enduring romantic mm-hmm. relationship. Is Russo showing here a certain pessimism about love and romantic relationships?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can see this again when you consider Miles, right? One character says of Miles that Miles is the kind of man that a woman could love without losing her self-respect. But interestingly, no one loves Miles in this book except Cindy Whiting, and Cindy Whiting tried to kill herself. So we we really have good reason to believe that in loving Miles, Cindy has lost her self-respect, if not herself. Right? So it seems like one thing Russo is saying is love essentially involves the lack of self-respect or the loss of self-respect.
What do you say about that view? I mean, is it in fact a fairly common view that somehow you have to give up your self-respect or at least constrain your self-respect in order to have a loving relationship?
Throughout the history of philosophy, yeah, it's everywhere. Socrates discussed it, Kant discussed it. In present times, a lot of feminist philosophers talk about how in loving somebody, there's a loss of self. Now, to me, I find this foreign, and I also find it contradictory to this other strand you get, which is that in loving somebody, you often find yourself. There's often a way in which when you finally find the person that you can love, you finally feel as if you can truly be yourself, right? So it's this interesting contradiction. One strand of philosophy says love is the loss of self, but then there's other strand in philosophy that says love is finding self.
Might it be that what you end up doing is you lose features of yourself in loving, but that doesn't mean that you lose yourself? I mean, if you're going to have a relationship with someone, it seems to me any kind of relationship with someone, that at least occasionally there are things that you might want to do or ways that you would want to do them that you can't do them if you're going to be with someone else and be at all sensitive to them and their interest and their needs.
Yes, of course.
But the problem may be in assuming that when you do that, you inevitably have to lose yourself and or lose self-respect.
Right. I mean, it's as if there's no give and take, right? Because I'm with somebody else, things about me will have to change, but not everything. And things about the other person will have to change. Why? Because I'm a person present and they need to respond to the person I am. The other thing is there's supposedly a kind of acceptance, right? So in other words, when you love somebody, the things that you don't know that are whether or not you want to keep or throw away, or the things that you value, which you don't know whether or not they are valuable, you finally find somebody to reaffirm that, hey, you're okay. The self that you are is all right.
Minimally, though, you'd say that there is something very important about the way in which loving relationships, long-term relationships, are going to affect people's sense of self, either maybe in losing it in some degrees, but also perhaps in finding it in some ways.
Right. I would like to just for a second talk about the one loving relationship that you liked, right? And it's the story of Otto Meyer. Otto Meyer is often described in the book as the one character who has a good sense of self. And given that, it's interesting that what I think Russo is saying is because Otto Meyer is living his true nature, embodying his true nature, he's the one person who is able to successfully form a relationship with somebody else. So at least for Russo, it seems like the only way you could be successful in love is if you have a sense of self. And if you don't have a sense of self, you're going to lose it even more or damage it even further by loving somebody.
Well, to that extent, then, his view that people have a human nature seems to run through the entire book and influence the other two issues we've talked about.
Yeah.
It influences whether people can or cannot fulfill their duties, and it influences whether people can or cannot have lasting, successful, happy relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the last 3.5 minutes or so of the show, I wanted to ask you really about the ending of the book.
Okay.
In particular, the very end of the book, Miss Whiting, who has sort of tormented, indirectly tormented Miles throughout the book, dies in a flood.
Mm-hmm.
I take it you didn't find that especially satisfying conclusion to the book. I wonder if you could briefly explain why.
All right. Well, Miles has a friend, and he's a priest. It's Father Mark. And Father Mark and Miles spend a lot of time pondering the nature of God. And their question, which is not an unfamiliar question, is God an Old Testament God or a New Testament God? All right, well, with that dilemma in mind, we need to consider again Mrs. Whiting. Mrs. Whiting is presented in this novel as pretty much an Old Testament God. She's all-powerful in the town of Empire Falls. She owns all the land. She's all-knowing. She can explain Miles better than he can explain can't explain himself. She's omnipresent. There are all sorts of scenes where she sort of pops up or is seen looking at somebody else. She's a kind of person that rewards people based on whether or not they do her bidding. All the qualities Mrs. Whiting has are qualities of an Old Testament God. All right, well, no one in the book ever gets the best of Mrs. Whiting. And as the book draws to a close, it looks like no one ever will. And I kind of think Rousseau was really unhappy with this. He created this character who is godlike in many ways and who is just too powerful and not the right kind of God. And I think he needed to get rid of her in some way and sort of bring back some hope. So what does he do? He has a flood wash her away. Well, a flood is an act of God. Right. And this kind of flood in Empire Falls that kills Mrs. Whiting brings justice back. Mrs. Whiting is the source of a lot of misery in Empire Falls. Killing her evens the balance out. It's clearly an act of a New Testament God, a loving God, right? A God that's busy doing other things, but when he gets around to it, he'll set things right in Empire Falls. But to me, this is a cheat, right? We have no evidence of this loving God anywhere else in the book. Only until the end does he sort of pop up out of nowhere, right? But wouldn't it be sort of more truthful to the book itself if Mrs. Whiting just lived and Miles had to sort of reconcile himself to that kind of God and become the man he needed to become in the face of that kind of God?
Either that or else she should have been depicted differently throughout the book in some ways. Okay. Any last-minute thoughts before we end the show that you would like to leave with a listener about this book?
Well, I guess I'm more curious about something that you once said to me that you found Tick to be a very interesting character, and I was always wondering why you liked Tick as a character.
Ah, okay. When I read the book, it seemed to me that she was, as I recall, 14, 15, that she had a level of understanding, maturity, and decency that is pretty hard for older people to accomplish, let alone younger people. That, I mean, for instance, you mentioned the case of John Voss, that she was asked to befriend John Voss. This was thrust upon her in the same sort of way that Miles was told to befriend Cindy, but it seemed to me that Tick took on the responsibility to a degree and in a way that Miles never did.
Yes.
That at some level, perhaps not as much maybe as she should have, but at some level she came to care for, not romantically care for, but care about John and tried to do things to really help him out, to make his life better. So, on my own reading, I would have said that Miles was being very minimalistic when it came to Cindy, that Tick seemed to have a level of, again, a level of care and concern that I didn't see in Miles or in many of the other characters in the book, and especially for someone so young. She also showed a certain amount of self-understanding that I thought was refreshing, and an understanding of adults at one point. In fact, when she has this responsibility thrust upon her, she sort of muses about the way that she can read adults. Because when adults are telling children to do something they don't really believe, they always look off to the side. So the combination of those traits were all the reason I found her so interesting.
Wasn't she a little too perfect, though, in that way?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. We'll see. Unfortunately, we're out of time. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today has been Rebecca Hanrahan of the Department of Philosophy. We've been discussing Richard Rousseau's Empire Falls. This is Ideas and Issues. Good day.